Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by two esteemed scholars and thinkers. The first is Isran Subramanian and Yoram Reich. Sub is a research professor at the Engineering Research Accelerator in Engineering and Public Policy Department at Carnegie Mellon University, and is a co-founder of Fields of View, a not-for-profit research organization that designs games and simulations for real-world social problems. Yoram is professor in the School of Mechanical Engineering and co-founder and head of the Systems Engineering Research Initiative at Tel Aviv University. We're going to be primarily talking about their new book, We Are Not Users, Dialogues, Diversity, and Design. And it's a pleasure to have both of them join me on an early morning here in Atlanta. I'm recording in Atlanta because I'm on the road. It's a pleasure to have them join me on The Deep Dive. How are both of you doing this morning?
Very well, thank you.
It's a pleasure being with you today.
That's what I like to hear. This is how I want to start my morning, with folks who are deeply engaged, who are thoughtful. And as we were chatting a little bit before we actually started recording, one of my comments about the book, and again, I highly recommend, you know, all my listeners to get this book and spend some time with it. I think it's the type of book that not only makes for a good initial read, but it's a book that can become a resource within your working or your academic library to really dig into the way in which they've tackled a topic that has so many different branches, but have managed to make that very accessible, very interesting, and also very thoughtful. So, Yoram, I'm going to start with you. What is the premise or the background behind We Are Not Users? How did this come to be birthed into the world?
That's a good question. Excellent question. I mean, it's a long journey of Saab, myself, and several other people who started working at Carnegie Mellon University. I mean, we came from different disciplines, different backgrounds. We sort of saw that the way that design was portrayed as a discipline of designers doing their task was not as we thought it should be. So we studied philosophy, we studied some other disciplines, and we came up with different ideas about democratizing design, about participation, about the fact that designers are not those who should be doing design for others, but should be facilitators of designs, empower others to design for themselves. So we don't expect designers to know everything, to be the decision makers, but help others who actually own the problems or the challenges to be able to approach these challenges in the best way possible. So this is what we mean by democratizing or empowering people. And then there is that notion of users in design, which I don't know if you are familiar with it, with the saying that there are only two things that consider people as users, and this is the computer, the IT industry, and the drug industry. So we really want to move people from that notion. I mean, people are not users of somebody else's designs, but they should take ownership and be able to design for themselves.
And Sub, I want to give you an opportunity to jump in there and obviously maybe even highlight a little bit that distinction of language around the term user, because that was... You know, you mentioned, you asked me offline, like how I've came to find your work and that kind of stuff. And really the title of the book was one of the things that really jumped out at me, because in my own work, I'm constantly pushing back against clients and organizations that use words like consumers, you know, mm-hmm. and it in my mind, it minimizes mm-hmm. the fullness of who we are as human beings. And so I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. So Sub, I'll shoot it over to you.
See, I come from a society like many others, including ours here originally, where things are divided into caste, race, this, and all kinds of ways we flatten each other. And it is this flattening that really doesn't allow us to solve problems the right way. And every individual has an experience which is unique with respect to the world they live in. And when you come to collective action, then it requires that we mobilize all the experiences and try to come to the notion that we are designers, we are together, we are creating a common destiny or common space where we want to go. And it is that drives this notion of not users and not flatten us into users, but to bring the richness of each of our experiences. As Yoram pointed out, in our group, there were people who were philosophers, engineers from almost every religion you can think of. And also in our group, there were people of not just binary people, let us put it that way. Okay. We did not as a group think of a person other than what is that they bring to the table and how can they contribute? How much are they committed to this idea of the collective, right? And it is the idea of the collective that is important for us. And I'll make one more remark on that, which is we also realize interdisciplinarity is very hard. And why is it hard? It is because if you don't have a common purpose, then each of us cannot walk in and walk out of the common purpose to see what is the common purpose is about, right? And also to bring the different lenses into the common purpose. So that is a very significant part of why we cannot treat people as users. We have to treat each one of them with respect that is accorded to their experience as well as their being. Whichever culture they come from, whichever background they come from, whichever identity they choose is irrelevant. That is their choice. But the problem is they are bringing a perspective that is not mine or yours or somebody else's. It's every individual and the collective has to merge together. It is this interaction between the individual and the collective that is the heart of design for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to stay on that point for a little bit, because, you know, to the casual person, whether they're a listener or not a listener, these choices of words sometimes comes down to semantics, right? Mm-hmm. This is what they'll say, that, you know, oh, consumer, it's just a marketing / business term, right? It's how we're trying to classify a group, a large subset or data point of people. You know, oh, user is just, like you mentioned, Yoram, it's a common term in the pharmaceutical or IT industry and other industries, right? We don't mean it to be weighed with whatever, right? You'll commonly hear these terms, right? And you talk about in the book, the language is a big focus of the book. And language is not benign. We choose words for purpose. Words have often very deep meanings. They put us in a particular mindset. So this time I'm gonna pick it up again with you, Sub, and then Yoram, we'll let you jump in. When you think about the choices of taking a word like a user and making it so common in the design space, what are the natural implications and weight of that choice relative to exploring other terms?
First of all, the minute you say user, you have already created a distance between you and the other person, right? In some sense, a drug dealer creates the space between you and himself. You know, as people say that you never eat your own stash to drug dealers, right? He never thinks of himself as a user. Think about it, right? Everybody else is a user. There is that distance that is created by the word user. I'm very sensitive to the use of words that create distance, whether it is in a hierarchical sense or otherwise. It's not that we don't have distributed responsibilities, but that doesn't mean there has to be a distance by which we exercise our authority over others. It is about, as I said, collective action. If it is about collective action, each of us are equally users as designers or as builders or as Amartya Sen talks about the notion of violence and identity, where he says, I'm a Bengali, I'm an economist, I'm a feminist, I am this. I'm not one person. I'm this multiple which is embedded in me. By moving you to a user, your multiple is taken away from you. And also the ability to mobilize your experience is taken away from you. And that creates a certain gap. It is a very, weak or insufficient way of understanding the problem or issues that come into play when you have different people are brought together. It is in that sense that the word user is actually a very insidious word in my mind, you know, of exercise of power itself.
Yeah, right? Yoram, I'm going to give you a chance to jump in there and talk about the sort of political and a general sense of the choice of using that word.
I'll just say that when you repeated what I said, you said the pharmaceutical and the IT. I didn't mean the general pharmaceutical. I meant the drug dealers and drug, that kind of drug industry.
Oh, see, I don't see a distinction.
Neither do I, given Purdue Pharma.
Actually, you are right. But no. That's fantastic because I mean, it's especially COVID and all these things. But and other things. Yes, you are absolutely right. But not all the public will understand these sort of fine distinctions. So it's much clearer to go to a drug dealer where everybody will agree. So talk about one aspect of it. I would like to talk about the aspect from the designer viewpoint. When you speak about users, you are being extremely arrogant. You think of yourself as being powerful, knowledgeable, know everything, and other people really don't have much to contribute. You know what their needs are, although you obviously ask or try to address their pains, as they say, or desires or needs. Yeah, you ask them, but you don't involve them in the process or much in the solution. So designers think that they know everything. They know. I mean, this is an extreme. I'm taking this to extreme, but they have the knowledge. They have the power to develop, and other people will just use it. And the way that will make them use it will market it for them. Will wrap it up with some more language terms and make it appeal to them. So what we wanted is to get away from that, really, and make designers extremely humble in the sense we have some skills, but we certainly are not knowledgeable in the problems or in the challenges that people have. They are the knowledgeable, they are the owners, and they should even saying that they should be part of the solution, it is already ridiculous. I mean, our task as real designers is to empower them so that they can actually manage the process. And if they want something from us, they'll call us. But it's not us who are going to manage. It's they who are going to manage and will be in their service.
I love what both of you are saying about this idea of the designer. And I often have a lot of people that are focused on design and its various facets on the show, because I feel like design is a term and a word that captures so many types of processes and ways of being and thinking in the world. But it doesn't capture everything, but it does give us frameworks that are useful and valuable in which to tackle challenges. But like most disciplines, there comes schools of thought. There's usually some sort of academic training and background that goes along with these things. Not always, but usually. And with that, there does instill a certain level of base of knowledge that distinguishes someone that doesn't have that base of knowledge. So I guess I'm asking not even a question around design specifically, but how we've chosen to organize our societies in many ways sort of exacerbate some of the challenges that we're talking about through this conversation, in the sense that, Sub, you mentioned distance. You know, and when I think about my own experience, whether it's going to certain schools or pursuing certain jobs, they were often in a way meant to create a certain distance from people who didn't do those things, right? Like, you're a white collar worker versus a blue collar worker. You're skilled labor versus unskilled labor. You're a, you know, what do they say now? I'm part of the knowledge economy versus working with my hands, right? Like, there's all these distinctions, right? So my question is, and Yoram, I'm going to give you an opportunity to start first this time. Given all of those just societal factors, how do we not have the hierarchies and distances that they just seem to build within our experiences, right? Like, even if I'm aware of them, if someone asks me, they'll say like, oh, well, you're part of the college educated demographic between here and here and here, right? And you know, that's meant to imply that, oh, you might have a different way of viewing the world because you have these experiences, right? So I'm, you know, it's a complicated, messy kind of question. You guys talk about how things are messy in the book, right? So I'm curious about how you wrestle with some of those things, right? As thinkers in this space, but also folks who, from my interaction with you, seem deeply engaged with widening the way in which we flatten. That word came up a little earlier. So Yoram, I'll start with you, and then Sub, we'll let you jump in there.
Yeah, I think what you're asking is extremely complicated, because everything around us is sort of structured in silos. And it's very difficult to collaborate together. Even in my university, there are interdisciplinary centers, yet it's very difficult to actually conduct interdisciplinary work where really people contribute to each other or create new concepts. And also for even for me, I find myself sometimes sort of trying to think, let's say, broadly, but I'm attracted to my experience, my profession. I think that the way to do it is to sort of operate in two levels and to have that level of reflection. So in a way, we cannot escape our, let's say, regular inclination to do things. But at certain point, we should also step aside and then reflect on what we are doing and say, am I stuck in my thinking? Am I listening to the other parties? Are they listening to me? Do we collaborate seriously? So if you manage to go up level, which is, I find from my experience, extremely difficult for people because they're usually stuck in their daily life. But if you actually go up level and reflect, this is your chance to modify things. I mean, I'll bring my my own culture. Let's say in Judaism, there is Yom Kippur, once a year, where people sort of have to reflect on what they did last year. So in the culture, there is a built-in reflection mechanism. But we could do it, let's say, on a weekly basis, even on a daily basis. How was my day? Was I stuck in my viewpoints when I talked to somebody? Did I listen? So, I mean, we need these two levels to be able to get out from these traps.
Absolutely. And Sub, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Like, how do we resist the flattening? And you're muted, so.
I want to start with the reference to Kendall's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. I'm sure you've seen that book.
Mm-hmm, I have. I haven't read it, but I've seen it.
Yeah, it is a struggle, right? It's a constant struggle. We are put in slots, and we are expected to behave in a particular slot. I'll personalize it for you. I come from a Brahmin family in the Indian context, right? That gives me certain privilege and authority within the society to a certain extent, like you said, an educated, whatever person you are. And you are expected to act accordingly. And if I want to move away from it, I have to stop thinking of myself as the Brahmin who is at the top of the hierarchy of the caste system, but just another person in this world who's experiencing the world together with you, thereby removing that distance, right? Fighting, you have to fight this distance every day. It is not a one-time thing, which is exactly what Kendall is also talking about, how to constantly think about how I don't want to be a racist. I want to be away from it. I want to talk about everybody as the same. Through this book, we also want to provoke this notion that leave all your baggage outside, come in with an open mind. Okay. The baggage is the distance. That is what has to be taken away, right? So in that sense, it's this constant struggle of identity and non-identity, as I would say. Both coexisting in the same person. Right? You cannot remove your identity, but at the same time, there is also a way to remove that identity and see that world in the other person's shoes. It's in that sense that I see a way for us to think about dialogue and diversity. Why dialogue and diversity? Diversity is the multiplicity of experience, and dialogue is the means through which we come to this common humanity that we are after.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad the diversity word came up. I'm gonna probably get to it in a little while, right? Because I'm going through trying to keep this as orderly as possible. But these concepts, they intermesh with one another, right? And as I was going through the book, there was a real call and or a demand for designers to those who consider themselves to be designers or work in design spaces, whatever those might be, to really take up the responsibility of being a designer. Like there, because the work touches so many different parts of our society, designers needed to work with an intention and understand the responsibility of what they were part of creating, whether it was tangible or intangible. And so I want you to spend a little bit of time, and again, Sub, I'll kind of ping it to you first, and then Yoram mm-hmm. will go to you. This idea of tangible and intangible and the responsibility that comes with that in the design space. Like, we're not only talking about iPhones and physical artifacts, things that we can touch and feel and hold in our hands and interact in the world with. We're also talking about intangible things, things that don't have a physical place in the world, but are artifacts nonetheless. You know, the notion of artifact comes up a lot, and I want to get to that next. But weigh in on how we think about those tangible and intangible elements as part of the design process, and then the responsibility that designers have to, I guess, steward those realities. So just some reflections on that, Sub, and then Yoram, I'll toss it to you.
You put a finger in on a very, very important point. And if you remember in the book, we say, Time said that the person of the year is you. It's very interesting. Even though it says you in the context of the computer revolution, but actually the you is actually being flattened a lot. You is being served by the computational world. And that is the tangible part, but the intangible part of it, which we are seeing through the distortions created by the social media and others. What is the responsibility of these designers? Is profit the only responsibility? Is there a responsibility for people who are building these large-scale systems, which involve society, to ask the question, what does it mean, right? It is not about picking your pocket every time you click. It is about what does it mean to you in a day-to-day basis? How does it change you? How does it affect you, right? So from that point of view, this idea that make it and break fast and we'll just throw it out there and see what happens is a very... Not only arrogant, very authoritarian idea that I know what you need, I know what you require, and I'm just giving it to you. And in some ways, the entire industry there, you know, if you go back to Papanek, you would say advertising and industrial design are the worst professions in the world, because you are being enticed. Your emotions are being manipulated here. It's not the product. It's not the artifact. It is the act that the artifact performs in your life. That is the intangible. And we tend not to see that. And it is in this sense that today's training in design and objectives in design is very directed towards serving a certain class of people, even though they claim they are serving the larger public, it is not really clear they are serving the larger public. Right? In that sense, they are getting very close to the drug dealers. Right? That's why the software guys and these guys are very similar. By distancing yourself and, oh, I'm providing a service to you. I'm creating servants for you. You know, your phone pings when you have to get up, when you have to sleep, when you have to do this. There is this butler they are creating for you. But this butler is not a human butler. He is a butler who is really manipulating how you structure your life. Right? And it is in this sense that we have to question and reflect upon, what do these artifacts do? I myself am subject to this phone, but to get out of it is hard today because you have dual factor authorization, you do this, you do that. So you are trapped in this net of technologies in order to function in a day-to-day way. And this is not what we envisioned computers for originally, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yoram, I'll let you weigh in there. Tangible, intangible, and the reality of artifacts.
Yeah. So I'm going to approach from a different angle. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. I want to say, I design, therefore I am. So in a way, this is the activity that underlines us being human. It's insufficient to think because let's say if I look at some objects, if one object think, I'm not sure that I will think that object is a human, but if it design, do something in the world, impact, I can see that impact. And depending on that, I may say that what I saw is an act of design, and I will ascribe to that object being human. This is So in a way, to me, whatever we do in design, we all our activities, I mean, we change things, we change the world, we change our future destiny. So part of this is tangible, part of this is intangible. I mean, us being happy, I will design what I do today, it will determine if I'm happy or not. If I do something even tangible and I'm completing it, I will have a sense of joy, which to me is sort of intangible. So I think design is sort of comprehensive human experience. And this is why it's so overarching and important. So I hope it answers your question.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to go even further with that, right? Because we've introduced this idea of artifacts and things, right? Things that exist in the world, both tangible and intangible. And Yoram, I'm going to start with you this time. In the context of the book, you guys weave in this idea of a shared memory, that we have experiences and we catalog them. And as we try to get to the root of something, we traverse this idea of the shared memory. And I think it's a beautiful concept, right? My question is it possible to have a shared memory? And to the extent that we have multiple shared memories, how do we intertwine them in a way that is effective, right? And just to give some background, right? Sometimes I think about, for example, the stories that you hear when you're growing up, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, when you were 3 years old, there that time you did this, right? And I kind of think to myself, well, I don't really have a memory of that, right? But I have an impression of this because it's been told to me so much, it's almost like the memory has been imprinted on me, right? Because I could see myself as a kid and I put myself in the context of this story, but I'm like, I don't really know if that's my memory, right? As much as it's a memory that's been given to me. So a very, personal sort of silly example, but I think about this because in the context of the nations that we live in, the groups that we belong to, there's so many shared memories, but how many of them are true? Many of them are mythologies that become now our identity. I sit in the United States, land of the free, home of the brave. Mm-hmm. Is it? I don't know, mm-hmm. right? Would someone who's indigenous view have that same shared memory of the land, right? So I'm throwing a lot out there, but you get the gist. Mm-hmm. Yoram, I'll let you go first, and then Sub, you can kind of pick it up.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. It relates to what we said before about diversity. Maybe we didn't mention the word perspectives, but and also dialogue. So each of us come with shared memory, our heritage, family, community. These are sort of spoken stories or sometimes oral, sometimes written stories that we are familiar with. And it's becoming part of us, as you just said. You don't remember that you went through the experience, but it's becoming part of you. And we also have shared memory of our profession. I mean, practices, how you do X or Y. What's expected of you in a society, okay? So the ethos of a particular society. So, I mean, that is something that is common and natural to people. The interesting is when you live in the two communities that have shared memory that may, I don't know, contradict or have different views, or when you collaborate with people who have different shared memory. And this is where dialogue comes into play. And I want to bring something into this dialogue, because in order for true dialogue to be present, it could be multiple people. Those people who are in dialogue need to feel extremely safe. So that it's not that their shared memory or whatever their experience is being challenged, but there is a true sense of attempt to bridge this shared memory, to understand the differences and to try to build a new common view of what it might be. It might not remove the contradictions or the differences, but it will build a bridge where one can understand other views, and perhaps on the bridge there could be something new built in that sort of merge together or build on top of together, that both parties agree that this can become their own shared memory while they manage their other shared memories. Okay, so they don't need to throw these things unless the challenge is such that they are willing to reflect and say, well, I need to leave this baggage, as Sub said before, I need to leave this baggage outside the room if I want to really collaborate.
As Yoram said, it's a very interesting question along multiple dimensions. Right? See, we are a collective species, as Chester Bowles and Guinness has written, a cooperative species, in humans as cooperative species. We are handed down over from our parents and other people the way we hunted, the way we dealt with the environment around us. It is this collective memory that has made the human a very successful species, the ability to carry the collective memory. In that sense, often people talk about cognition as this individual entity who is cognizant of everything. But Hutchins would argue that cognition is something which is inside out and outside in. The story you told about your three-year-old experience when you were three is actually there within you somewhere. It's not accessible to you because over time, you know, we have to forget to survive, and you know, given the past. But it is kept alive through your mother telling you, or whoever is telling you. So in some sense, this collective notion of memory is both a form of laughing at ourselves and reflecting on ourselves, and also to convey the failures. After all, we are humans, we are frail, we make mistakes. To learn from each other's mistakes, to learn from what they have gone through, how different structures have put us in the places where we are. We cannot liberate ourselves from that unless we know the other person's experience and how there is some commonality. We may have struggled against two different things, but they are equally legitimate to be accepted so that we can learn from each other and build the collective memory of a society. Right. And we built libraries, we built all of these things, is to preserve the collective memory. Yes, you're right, not everybody can know all the pieces of the collective memory, but it's a continuously evolving shared memory. It's not a static memory. The sharing itself produces a certain amount of changes and evolution of the collective, and that's why theory and practice intersect through the shared memory.
And Yoram, it looked like you wanted to jump back in.
Yes, because at least my previous comment was, and maybe your question was, that this is difficult to reconcile when you have different shared memories. But this is sort of the negative position, but I want to pose it as an opportunity. Engaging with people with different shared memory has the potential to challenge our shared memory and extend it, improve it, and not get stuck in ideas that do not contribute to us. So we should seek to speak to other people with different shared memories, and not just it's the same as when you are let's say CEO of a company. Don't get people who think like you. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, get people who think different than you, and then get all the different experiences and viewpoint, and then you can excel. So we should consider it as an opportunity and not as a challenge only.
Absolutely. I I agree, but I know it's harder. it's harder in practice, which doesn't make it not worthwhile. But I think of so many organizations that will say, you know, we're looking for people who think outside the box. We want to be challenged. We know we're looking for, you know, as someone who is outside of organizations and come into organizations to help them work on challenges. They'll say, you know, this is exactly what we need. But then when you start to get into the work of it, then they say, oh, well, you know, we don't really want to move that fast, or, you know, this sounds good, but, you know, and I'm sharing these sort of random examples because what I find is often people broadly, you know, whether it's an organization or individuals, when you're kind of talking with a friend or, you know, partner or whoever it is, they want you to more validate what you already think rather than to really fully challenge it. And one of my least favorite statements, and I'm sure everybody's been there, you know, and it doesn't have to be like a big serious thing, but you could be talking to a friend, going back and forth. It could be something as silly as a sports analogy, right? Like, I think this player in this sport is the best. I think this player in this sport is the best. You have this argument, right, over beer mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, somebody says to the other person, oh, that's great, but, you know, let's agree to disagree, right? And I hate that statement, right? Like, it's one of my pet peeve statements, because I feel like when someone says that to me, they're almost like dismissing everything I've just said, and we've just landed in our two buckets, right? Now, if you're discussing Michael Jordan versus, you know, LeBron James or Kobe Bryant, who cares, right? It's not that serious. But when you're having more substantive conversations about the way in which our world works, and someone says, oh, well, you know, let's just agree to disagree, I'm like, you're choosing cordiality over like a real solution or moving toward a solution. So I don't know if there's a question in there, but I'm trying to like lean into the challenge of this work when people sometimes are very resistant to confrontation. And I say confrontation, it doesn't mean like we're mad, but they just don't want to get into it. So it's easier to say, oh, let's agree to disagree. Right. So again, I don't know if there's a question in there, but I want to get your reflection on that. And, you know, mm-hmm. I guess I'd have forgot who went first last, but Yoram, I'll let you go and then Sub. Okay. If you have thoughts on that, I'll let you jump in as well.
My perspective would be, let's say, speak about myself. I'm thinking all the time, how do I do things better? How do I improve? Obviously, I see that I'm not perfect in doing various things. So I want to improve. And the only way to improve is to get, I mean, really, how do I get out of my box? Really, I need to see other things. I need to see other options, other ways of thinking. And sometimes I can do it by reading, by looking in different directions, and also I can by talking to people, by seeing, hearing their experiences, their shared memory, and by finding the contradictions of the way that my memory tells me how to do and theirs, I find new ways. So I would seek such experiences all the time. I mean, talk to different people. I mean, even now, I mean, you have different experiences. Obviously, me and Sab share, we are almost the same person after so many years. I mean, we know each other over 30, 35 years. Working together, sometimes we, over Skype, we tell each other good night or good morning. So our spouses may talk to us less than we talk to each other sometimes. But any experience as this one, I mean, you poke us, you challenge us with your question, and we have to think and expand or even express our ideas in slightly different ways. And suddenly, okay, that's interesting. I mean, I said something that I didn't think before. Interesting, I'm writing it down. So I'm expanding. So every meeting of different shared memories or diverse shared memories, diverse people create a dialogue and something new gets built if we are willing to accept it.
Yeah, I want to jump in the following way.
Yeah.
Because when I came to this country, I came to the South, to South Carolina. I was in Columbia in 1976, right? I wanted to understand this country in its deepest form. I used to bring people to vote from different communities precisely to understand how this so-called greatest democracy is not a democracy after all in a lot of ways. Because I do come from a biggest democracy, the question of diversity and inclusion are very, very important. So from that point of view, I wanted to understand the institutions of this country, which made the country what it is and what is being thrown away, neglected, not told. I was just in Charleston, and every time I go to Charleston, I think about the fact that without the people from Africa, most of these people would have died. They didn't know how to sew, make cotton. They didn't know how to use the waves to push the cotton bales in a ship out to the sea, understanding the cycles of the sea. When there is high tide, you load up in low tide, and when there is high tide, the high tide will take you back to the sea. So these are all experiences. America was built out of the multiplicity of experiences. But, you know, now we are in a period where we want to deny those things by banning books. You know, you can't read Toni Morrison anymore. You can't do this. You know? This is a conscious destruction of the shared memory. It is antithetical to what we believe is the mobilization of the collective. And unless the collective is mobilized every day in every form, we cannot solve our problems, whether it is climate change or anything else. It's in that sense that I'm answering this question, that we are in a paradoxical situation of wanting to mobilize the collective, at the same time prevented from mobilizing the collective. Remember, I also come from a colonized country. The amount of indigenous knowledge that was destroyed during the British colonialism is also part of this power relationship, which denies one's own collective memory and the ability to deal with things. So that is why even if we are in silos, bridging allows us to find ways to find the common experience, which becomes the foundation for not saying, let's agree to disagree.
Yep. Absolutely. I'm agreeing and I'm smiling because I understand, like, we're talking in the same language, and that's why it's so incredibly frustrating to absorb these moments, right? Because when we should be expanding and pulling in more ways of thinking, it's actually going in the opposite direction, right? And it allows me to, you know, talk about boundary objects. Like, this was a really, like, interesting part of the book to me, because it talked about, and I'm paraphrasing here obviously, but, you know, we have this, you know, ways in which disciplines work and operate, and we look for the commonalities within them, right? And even though in the book we're using you know, industry examples and stuff, I think the examples that both of you have shared that are more personal and or societal the same notion applies, right? That we have within these disciplines, you try to find where there's intersections at these boundaries. What are the boundary objects that like pull people together? And that was really intriguing to me because, and you mentioned this, Yoram, specifically, that even though you're in a university that prides itself on being interdisciplinary, it's still very hard to work across disciplines, right? And I feel like that exists everywhere, right? Like, despite the fact that the problems that we have, the challenges that we face, whether micro or macro, are wicked problems, as they like to say, they require so much thought. It's impossible for any one narrow discipline to solve them, but yet it feels to me, and so this is kind of my opinion, that we're championing being more specific than ever, right? That we, you know, when I was growing up, we took a multitude of classes, right? We took English, we took, you know, I went to an engineering school, so we did engineering courses and all kinds of stuff like that. But you were encouraged to, oh, go take courses in liberal arts, go do these kind of things. Now I see, like, at least in the United States, right? From the United States perspective, you know, everything is like, oh, kids should be doing STEM, right? Because that's where the jobs are and that's what matters. And I'm like, can't they just read like Huckleberry Finn? Right? Like, you know, like, why has it got to be about like, everybody's got to learn to code. If you don't know how to code, you're falling behind, right? I'm like, our problems are not going to be solved by just coding, right? So these are, again, very simplistic examples, but I thought about them in the context of boundary objects, that this notion is so important, but yet in so many institutions, we're narrowing. And it seems like that's the exact opposite of what we should be doing. So Sub, I'm going to let you start first, and then Yoram, let you pick up, like, to think about how these two forces are at counterpoints there.
It's a very deep question because it's about social, political, economic environment in which we live in. The socio-political environment we live in today engenders a language of speed. Do things faster, quicker, somehow augment yourself, I mean, replace people's speed because it is not fast enough or it's not slow enough or it's cumbersome to maintain it. It's almost denying the humanity of ourselves by saying, oh, the world will take over, it will be taken over by robots and they will serve us. And we know from the days of Industrial Revolution that every time they said, oh, all these technology is going to bring more leisure, they never did, and they still don't, right? It's a mirage that has been given to us that somehow there is going to be leisure someday for all the world. Of course not everybody gets the leisure, just as the aristocrats of England and UK got their leisure, but not the guy working in the factory. And in fact, what was interesting is just yesterday, there was a review of a book called Blood in the Machine. It just came out recently, which I thought was fantastic. I have to get it.
I'm going to give a quick plug. I'm just going to interrupt you for one second because Brian's actually going to be on the show.
Lovely.
I've read the book and Brian's going to be on the show. So continue your point about Blood in the Machine.
We were told a mythology that Luddites were against technology. They were not against technology. They were against the power being taken away from them by the machine. Right? It's that they were not allowed to form unions, present their case, and the machine was used as a bludgeon to push you down as much as possible. And we are seeing the same thing today. It's the continuation of the Industrial Revolution to push the human away in order to in the service of profit, if you want to call it, right? Which is exactly what I've just read the reviews of the book. I need to get the book and read it now. And I'm really fascinated by it. Because, you know, if you go back, there was a movement in the early 1920s in the U.S. by this famous woman, Mary Parker Follett, who talked about the fact that every worker possesses a knowledge that is useful to the firm. It's the way you organize the society in terms of appreciating each experience and the education that can come out of that experience to everybody in terms of mobilizing the firm. That way, Blood in the Machine really points to the fact that it is about power amplification of some people over others through the machine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Yoram, I'll let you jump in there to kind of weigh in on this boundary objects and specificity and all the rest of it.
So I want to make a distinguish between two types of boundary objects. One is created in the, let's say, academic world in science. There, the boundary objects are extremely specific. Usually it will be scientific papers in journals. So different disciplines publish in their own journals, in their own type. Different other people find it hard to read. You don't integrate these things. And these objects are judged by citations, by impact factor, all these kinds of things that were invented by the academic world. So these are extremely specific boundary objects. Now let's move to reality. Reality boundary objects is what we see around us. Transportation system, a healthcare system. I mean, these are extremely complicated systems that you cannot break down to these disciplinary silos because they are integrating multiple perspectives together. So there is a huge distinction between these different boundary objects. And really, one might say that science does not contribute significantly to the improvement, let's say, in our transportation systems. Of course, we have new technologies but we are stuck, I think, in difficult transportation system, in healthcare system, in social system problems. And design is the thing that actually, bridges these things. Because design is the thing that has to take the specific boundary object or specific knowledge and specific experiences that different people have and integrating together to some kind of whole, which is these boundary objects in reality that sort of are in dialogue, but they are not merely a combination, a simple combination. There is something extra among them. So there is sort of a dialogue. I mean, it's something we say in the book, we can understand the larger boundary object also through the specific. And we need to understand the specific through the larger. We cannot understand without each other, but they are different, and we should acknowledge that they're not the same.
Can I add one thing quickly?
Yeah, go for it.
You see, we have always heard of the word pigeon and Creole. What are they? They are actually boundary objects between the colonizer and the colonized. I don't need to know everything about your language, you don't need to know everything, but we created a means by which we communicate with each other. Well, we can argue how the Creole was used in subjugation and so on, and that itself provides us with that boundary object historically looks one way, boundary operationally looks another way. And in a way, Brian's book on Blood in the Machine is now he's using the machine as the boundary object to unpack from a different perspective, right? And that is what every object in some sense is a boundary object because of the way it can be interpreted, it can be elaborated, it can be dialogued about to see its fullness.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you bring in, because my family's from the Caribbean and I grew up hearing, the term pidgin English was used mm-hmm. a lot, right? And as I got older, I learned more about oral traditions, both in the West Indies and also in the Americas. You know, you like you said, you learned that the use of language was used to talk plainly to those who you were trying to share a message with, but yet confuse the colonizer or the slave master, right? Because they didn't understand fully what you were saying. Things had double meanings and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not a language theorist, but these things always interest me, right? And I thought, you know, back in the day, hip hop used to do the same thing. Like if you didn't understand hip hop, if you didn't understand deeply the language, you couldn't understand hip hop. You might like the beat, you might like the song, but the message was underneath, right? And that's the power of culture. So I love that example and what you guys are sharing. Mm-hmm. I want to get you out on this question.
I want to make one more quick
remark. Go for it.
In science, in multidisciplinarity, for example, in the CERN, the nuclear, I mean, the accelerator, particle accelerator in Switzerland, when people studied, Peter Galison from Harvard studied, and he said there is a trading zone between different disciplines, and that trading zone is where the pidgin or Creole comes to be, and it happens in science as much as it happens in any other human endeavor. When two groups or two tribes come together, the Creole gets created. And that's where we get dialects. That's where we get all kinds of variations in language, because they're all bridges.
Absolutely. I want to get you guys out on this question before we get to the drop. So the drop is going to be the final part of the show where we recommend something, anything at all for our listeners. But I want to get you a chance to reflect on the future / futures. There's a section in the last section of the book kind of talks about the future. And there's a line, I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, where broken dialogues, like we spent so much time talking about dialogues, and there's a line or a section that says something like broken dialogues are what maybe not prevent the future, but they're impediments to the future. And I want to give you both an opportunity to weigh in on, you know, how do we take these concepts, these notions, these ideas, avoid the broken dialogues, and then start to create some of these futures that I think we can all see but can't quite grasp, you know? So Yoram, I'll let you go first, and then Sub, you can weigh in, and then we'll get to the drop.
Okay, let's say how the future is going to look like. I'm an optimist by nature, but the broken dialogue happens all the time, because at some points in that this last hour, we mentioned the political issues, social issues. I mean, it's not just technology and iPhones and stuff like this. So there is serious power struggle that is involved. So I'm not sure how it will end. I mean, it's clear that it's very difficult. This is why, let's say, our discussion may bring these issues further to other people. I mean, this is sort of a campaign, a sort of grassroots, a bottom-up campaign that as more people join, there's better chances, or that it will happen in small or larger communities, but not everybody. I mean, for my part, I teach these concepts to about 100 students in Tel Aviv University. So this is my role in trying to improve, in empowering them to have the kind of skills that we talk in the book, so they can, in my turn, design their life, basically better engage as participants in democracy better. But it's a sort of big campaign. It will take time. So
the way I would answer this question of the future is really goes back in my mind to teach design from elementary school, where they have to bring things together. They understand that the little math they learn and little language they learn and the history they learn, they're all coming together in their day-to-day lives. So that you really want to create a reflective person who's always reaching out to find What is that I can learn from the other? And with the minute you say the other, often what comes to mind is, he's different. I have to keep away from that different person. No, it is the other that is the opportunity to enhance the ability to reflect. Right? Now, we are in America today. The kind of forces that are operating today is dividing us in terms of the other rather than wanting to understand each other. And you are talking about broken dialogues. We are a country of broken dialogues in the sense that the poor person, irrespective of race, is suffering from the same problem, but they are not talking to each other. They have been prevented from talking to each other in some cases, to know each other's history, right? So when tribalism starts taking the notion of, I am superior to the other, or my experience is more privileged to the other, then dialogue will naturally be broken. It is the question then becomes, I'm as equally privileged to have lived and live in this world as the other person. What is that I bring from that privilege? So we are all equally privileged or equally deprived. You have to understand that irrespective of whatever wealth you may have, whatever education you may have, right? It's this paradox, right? You are privileged and deprived simultaneously. Right? To recognize that allows us to think about how do we bridge the broken dialogues.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, you've given me a lot to think about, you know, which is the point of the show. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while, and it definitely did not disappoint me. We could go on for another hour, but we can't. We could, but we can't all at the same time. One of those paradoxes. So I want to get to the drop. And the drop, like I said, is an opportunity to share anything at all that you think might be interesting to the listeners out there. And so I'll go first. I have two drops. Both of them are television shows. One of them is like a quick documentary. It's called Bye Bye Barry, and it's on Amazon Prime here. And it's a documentary about arguably one of the best running backs. It's arguable that he might be the best running back, but it's not arguable that he's one of the best running backs. Barry Sanders, who famously played for the Detroit Lions, a team that was very bad. He was the best part of that team, probably still remains whatever was the best of the Detroit Lions. And he very famously retired, seemingly at the peak of his running back abilities. And this documentary sort of documents why he walked away from the game of football. I watched it recently. I used to be a very fanatical football fan. When I say football, I'm referring to the NFL. I no longer watch the NFL because they are anti-union and they do not care about the safety of their players. And so I gave up football many years ago, but I still find that this documentary is not about football per se, as it is about his human experience and what was important to him. And so from that perspective, I think it's a very interesting documentary. So I'm recommending it. And the other show that I thought was very interesting is called High on the Hog. And it's a documentary on Netflix. And it traces the history and traditions of African-American food and tells a historical story about its place in American history. So it's very interesting. It has two seasons, but each season I believe has four episodes. So it's not overly long, but it is very interesting. You will learn about history, you will learn about food, you'll learn about culture. It's just very well done. And so those are my two drops, two shows this episode. So Yoram, I'll let you go first with your drop or drops. It can be plural, but one is fine.
Okay, so I'll have two because they contradict each other. So the first one is Akira Kurosawa's movie Rashomon, story about rape and murder, and the four characters that speak about it and present it from different positions, and at the end, we don't know really what happened there. So there is no conclusion. There is no, let's say, single design object that we can, no boundary object that we can say, okay, this is it, what happened. Another thing is I encourage listeners to go and see live jazz music and see the different players interact, build on each other playing, and look at them, look at the fun that they have, look at their excitement, and share with them that experience that something new is created and how joyful it is when they really have that desire to create something new. So these are completely different experiences with completely different sense of feeling at the end of them, and they might be interesting, I think.
I love it. I love it. Those are awesome. When you come to New York, we'll have to go check out some jazz together. We're going to put that on our respective calendars, you know. Oh, Stubb, I'll let you go.
I'll just add to your, even Indian classical music is a dialogue between the different instruments. In fact, it's closer to jazz than the West classical in Western music or even chamber orchestra. Just to add to what Yoram said, I've only seen parts of the movie. I've seen interviews with it. It's on my list to see. Is the movie Everything Everywhere All at Once? A recent movie with this Chinese lady who's the actress, I forget her name now, is really about being in multiple places at the same time. It is the same person. It is surreal, but in a way, we live a surreal world every day. We don't recognize it because we are there in multiple places, in multiple identities, and multiple places, multiple identities, and multiple representation of ourselves in different places. So it's this multiplicity that is part of us that comes out apparently from what I understand from this movie, and I have to say, I have to see it. I read quite a bit about it and interviews with the lady. And I think this is a very important concept that needs to be brought in. And the second book I would say this time is one of my favorite writers is Italo Calvino, the Italian writer, who is a master of metaphors. You know, he's written several books, even though his first book was about fascism. And subsequently, he wrote this book called Mr. Palomar. And Mr. Palomar is a very fascinating book because Mr. Palomar is trying to figure out to create one single logic of the world. And after going through a variety, I can go on forever, but a variety of different contexts, a day in the beach, a day in the backyard, watching the birds, to everything. And in the end, he comes and says, there is no single model by which we can describe the world. There is no single theory of everything, but what we have are models that are usable in the context in which we are operating. So there is this notion that there is no absolute, but that doesn't lead you to moral relativism, but it leads you to contextual relativism in terms of how you operate. I think these two really come to my mind right off the top of my head in terms of a movie and a book. There are others that I could also bring in. I had one in my head and it disappeared. But anyway, food, like you pointed out about the influence of food. And I think looking at different books, cookbooks from different parts of the world will give you the similar experience of the multiplicity of design, sometimes with the same ingredients.
Yeah, those are awesome drops. You know, I can't really thank you both enough. One, for, you know, your willingness to come on the show and engage in kind of a very wide-ranging but interesting conversation, for your work in having created this book. And, you know, I look forward to us doing this again. I think we left a lot on the table, which I knew we would, because there's so much to cover. But, you know, the book is really, like I said this at the beginning of the show, it is not only well-written, well-researched, and well-thought-out, but it is a really delicate, like, provocation of how we can think about the world that we live in as it pertains to our place in it as fully formed human beings, not just as users. Again, the book is called We Are Not Users, Dialogues, Diversity, and Design. Sub, Yoram, I want to thank you both for being on the Deep Dive and joining me on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
Thank you very much for inviting us. And the listeners don't see us, but I'm smiling, which means we had an excellent, joyful dialogue.
Absolutely. There's smiles in all three of our windows, even though folks can't see them. Thanks so much, gentlemen. This has been great.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.